Main speaker for this evening, Dave M. from Palm Desert.
My name is Dave Marquez. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My God-given sobriety day is May 9th, 1993. That's the day that God came between me and alcohol for the last time. I'd like to thank the committee and Larry and everybody that made this possible for me to come share my experience, strength, and hope with you. You're the timekeeper? Yes, sir? Okay. I need that. I've recently started going to O&O. You guys know what that is? It's for on and on disease. So, and those of you that were there this morning and this afternoon, you know that that is pretty close to true, right? 6 hours, and we barely got through the third step. You know, we had fun though, right?
Yeah.
I'm really stoked. I'm really stoked because my friends are here. I'm really stoked that Marty's here. This is what a God shot, Marty. Marty and I came in about the same time in AA in Clovis, California in 93. And we've known each other off and on just because we've traveled so much in our sobriety that he's just here, you know, and it's great. And he's also going to be the truth keeper over there because he was there before I did steps, okay, for my first year of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got to see that hot mess. So, so I either talk about that and talk about that honestly, or I just skip it all together and try to look good, right? Anyway, Marty, it's awesome to see you. Okay. And just shout out, he's lying anytime. That's fine. Lips are moving. Wow. You know, this is going to be the evangelical part that Brian skipped. No, it's not really. I went through that, didn't I, Marty? The evangelical stage, we went through that. And it burned a lot of people out, so I didn't really, it's a reputation that still follows me around. 20 years later, but that's not what we're going to do here tonight. I just want to share with you my experience, strength, and hope of being Alcoholics Anonymous and participating in this program and in the fellowship for the last 20-something years, okay? I'm still blown away that I get asked to do these kinds of things because of where I came from when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Clovis wasn't the first place I was introduced to AA. I was actually introduced to AA in a hospital room at Triple Army Medical Center in 1992, around this time of year, 23 years ago. I was 23 years old. I was 3 years into a four-year Marine Corps hitch, and that's where alcoholism eventually took me, to a lockdown facility for alcoholic insanity. And how I got introduced today is I had an H&I call on me that was not a official H&I call. It was more of like a man in the bed scenario, like you see the little picture on the wall in some rooms of AA of Dr. Bob and Bill talking to Bill D. And what happened is I got some good news about getting out of the Marine Corps early, and I thought I'd start celebrating. And alcoholism was killing me, even though I didn't know it was alcoholism. I knew I drank too much. But it's like we used to say back in the meetings in Utah, you know, being a drunk and being an alcoholic aren't necessarily the same things if you don't know the difference, right? I was a drunk. I didn't know I was an alcoholic at that time. I got some good news, and I had been went out to deliberately get drunk. You know what the book says about people that go out and deliberately get drunk? It's always worse. And so I went batshit crazy, and I ended up in the psychiatric ward. And I came to, and I was shake, rattle, and rolling, DTs and all that stuff. And then on that Sunday, these two guys came into my room, and one of the guys was my roommate in the Marine Corps who had been sober about 10 months. And it's weird. He became sober, and he was all of a sudden a jerk. He was a jerk, right? My drinking didn't bother his sobriety, which really irritated me. And his sobriety, was bothering my drinking. You know, it was awful, you know. And so he says he brings his sponsor with him, and they do this man in the bed thing, and they don't preach to me, they don't cram a book down my throat, and they just tell me what's going on, you know, and what they've been doing in AA. And it was an experience that was extremely impactful, and it's something that I try to continue to perpetuate ever since. And the activity was that two recovered alcoholics came in to see the sick alcoholic. I didn't have to go fetch them. They were doing their job that day. And they came in and offered me Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want it, didn't think I needed it, but they're doing their job that day. They planted a seed. And but before that, it wasn't like all of a sudden I became alcoholic in the Marine Corps. We were talking about this earlier today. You know, I first started drinking just like not everybody else, but a lot of the people around young teenage years. And my drinking was not yet continuous. I did not identify any kind of craving or anything like that. Just drinking it where I could get it, when I could get it. But by the time I was 15 years old, I could tell that something was going on between me and alcohol. That once I started drinking, it was like I just couldn't really stop when I wanted to. Okay. And then by the time I was 17, I was living out of my car. Or I was hanging out with people that were two and three times my age, doing what adults do, and a boy in a man's world. And trying to be a man and scared shitless. I wasn't seeking lower companionship, because by that time I was lower companionship. I went from being this really popular guy in school, and people wanted to hang around and everything. And by the time I was a senior in high school, nobody wanted to be around me. I was like this like lone wolf, right? Like the book talks about. Nobody wanted to be around me. And the high school I went to nearly kicked me out for being a bad influence on the other students. I only needed a certain set of classes to graduate. And I actually had a full load. And first or second day of my senior year, the counselor, the dean, the sheriff, had a little private meeting with me. And they said, well, we're going to cut out all these classes. And we're going to leave you with the first three periods of classes. Then you just need to get off campus. Which was fine to me, because I'm from God's country. I'm from a little mountain town outside of in between Yosemite and Kings Canyon National Park. And so that's a golden ticket for me. I can go drink and eat mushrooms on the lake or out in the high country until I couldn't stand it, you know. So that didn't seem like punishment to me. But my drinking was definitely out of control. I was sleeping in the little state parks and bonfires and stuff like that out there with the bears and shit, you know. And then started getting into trouble with the law. Started doing the round robins in the drunk tanks. All the drunken disorderlies, the DUIs. I had two DUIs before I was even 21 years old. By time I was halfway through, or near the end of my 1987, when I was 18, I got the brainy idea that I should probably I'll just go in the Marine Corps. Right? That was my geographical. I'm going to go in the Marine Corps. I'm going to straighten my life out and go in the Marine Corps. I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to go get a real job, because work was like a four-letter word, you know. So the idea of going around the going around the world and getting drunk on taxpayer dollars and getting an opportunity to kill people that I didn't know, it sounded really enticing. So that's what I did. The problem was is that I had this thing called alcoholism that and with that alcoholism I had this thing called a phenomenon of craving. And it took me 3 tries to actually get to boot camp over a 2-year period because I kept getting drunk and arrested at my going away parties. True story. Scout's honor. I thought it was street cred. We were talking about that at dinner. That's like street cred, right? So they wouldn't let me go until I had my fines paid and all this other stuff, and nobody was bailing me out. Nobody could care. Nobody could really gave a shit and stuff. So they would prolong these, put me back on this delayed entry program. I get arrested. They put me on the delayed entry program. I get arrested. It was that kind of thing. And finally, I was standing in front of the judge, and he was tired of me. Okay? You know, it's really, I don't know if it's cool or if it's bad, but to me at the time it was cool that the picture lady coming out of the drunk tank or going into the drunk tank in the Fresno County Jail, she knew me, right? You're here again. Hey! You know, it's like, just, you got the old one? You know? Just a couple weeks ago. So the judge says, he says to me, look, here's how this is going to go. You're either going to go do a year with me or you're going to do 4 years in the Marine Corps. What do you want to do? And I, at the time, I know it's hard to believe now, but I was about 135 pounds soaking wet. And I thought, well, I was probably too sexy for jail, you know? I didn't want to find out. And I was just now beginning to think about embarking on a new virginity, so I didn't want to break that either, you know? So I decided that I'd just take the 4 years in the Marine Corps. It sounded a lot safer, or at least not as painful. he said, okay. And so he ordered me into the custody of the Marine Corps recruiter. So I had to live with my Marine Corps recruiter for 1 week because he told the recruiter, you got to get him out of here. And the recruiter said, okay, yeah, we'll just get him back on the debt program and we'll get him out. He says, oh, no. You don't get it. This man is a drunk. He can't stay sober long enough on your delayed entry program to make it to a ship date. Haven't you figured that out yet? So you either get this paperwork in order and get him out of here in a week, or he's with me for a year. And he's going to go live with you for that week. Because that then maybe he can stay away from me. That guy was living it up for that week. He never seen so many girls. He never seen so much booze. He was a happy camper. I don't know if you can make somebody an alcoholic, but I tried. Oh, is he happy to see me leave? So I went in the Marine Corps, and I did what I did in the Marine Corps. And by that time, alcohol had ceased to be a luxury, and the party was long over. This was not about partying down anymore. Okay, I went to Desert Storm. I was in recon. I was there, you know, where CNN wasn't, all that stuff. Okay, I've been bombed. I've been gassed. I've been shot at. Oh yeah, there was no gas there. The whole nine yards. And when all that stuff was going down, at some point the fear kind of went away, and it was like, at least for me, and not everybody, but at least for me and a lot of the other guys, was like, okay, let's just get this and go home. Okay? But I got to tell you, at the end of my drinking, before going into the psychiatric ward, just to go out and do the laundry off base, because I do my laundry off base, I can't stand to be on base. I used to have to do it with a bottle with me. Just to go do the laundry. Just to go do everyday things that everybody else does naturally sober. And I would sit there in the laundromat watching the dryer go round and round and round with a fifth of Jack Daniels between my legs under the seat. And here comes these mothers and their kids in there looking at me cross-eyed like I'm crazy. And I'm looking at them like they're crazy. What, you never seen anybody sitting in a laundromat with a fifth of Jack Daniels between their legs? Like, because that's normal, right? Our life seems the only normal one. And so the party was long over at that time. And I was skipping down that road to hell with a smile on my face. Okay? It was miserable. It sucked. I had good times with alcohol, but I just thought that was part of it. I was willing to take the bad with the little bit of good that was left in that I was finding in alcohol. So I end up in Trip where I'm there, and I spend a week there. I come out, and that's where I got this scar. Before I went into it was a big brawl out in front of the bar, and so I couldn't defend myself. So I was just a punching bag. And so I came out, and these guys from my platoon, they picked me up, and I still had the wristband. I still had the stitches here, 40 stitches right here. And we were going to go get some Mexican food and celebrate me getting out of the psychiatric ward. And we couldn't get in, and we had to wait. We had to wait in the bar. And I'm thinking, man, it sure would be bad form to just start drinking right now, wouldn't it? I mean, you got to at least wait 24 hours to come to psych ward. You got to probably just wait. And so I'm with my buddies, and the lady comes around to ask for drinks, and she goes, she's asking everybody what they want, and I'm saying to myself, just say Coke, David, just Coke, 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 Coke. And she walks up to me and says, "And what would you like to have, sir?" And I said, "I'll have a Budweiser and a shot of Jack Daniels, please." And my friend, it's like the book says, you know, the person that's mystified when you walk right back into the saloon after what we do. And my friend in the Marine Corps, like, you know, it's bad when your Marine Corps buddies tell you to drink too much, right? And so he looks at me, his mouth is like this on the table, like, "What the hell are you doing? Are you crazy?" Well, yeah, kind of, you know? So it was just like riding a bike. Just get back on, right? What's the big deal? Go to the hospital once in a while, right? I've always said if alcoholism, if all there was to it, was running to the cops once in a while and going to the emergency rooms once in a while, I'd still be out there doing it. That's no big deal, you know? It was the soul sickness that brought me down, you know? And then I spent, I was off on another run, and I ended up back in the same place for 8 weeks. It was a 6-week program, but I was doing so well, they gave me the bonus 2 weeks. And this time, I was a captive audience. And they were treating me for everything under the sun. Inner child, lost child, only child, PTSD, oh, and also alcoholism. And I sat there and I listened, you know, and I participated and ignored them and participated and ignored them. And I came out of there with a certificate that said my brain was fixed, right, 8 weeks later. And so this time I have some friends in AA, the guys that had came to see me, my roommate and some guys that had taken me under their wing that were big book guys, but I wasn't convinced that that's how you have to stay sober. Nor was I even sure I wanted to stay sober. And maybe I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Anybody can get in a fight outside of a bar, right? I mean, everybody drinks coming out of the hospital, right? And so these are the guys that come to pick me up, my sponsor and my grand sponsor. And they pick me up, and we're going to get some dinner. Sounds similar, eerily similar, right? Different guys, AA guys. And we can't get a table, so we got to wait in the bar. And I'm thirsty. And my grand sponsor looks right at me, Will Warner. He says, "You want a drink, don't you?" I said, "I could kill one." We had a Normie friend with us that was just there to support me. And I was going to be a designated driver for him if he had some drinks while we had dinner back to the base. So he said, "Just hand me the keys." And you know that line says, "I think I was being none too smart." I handed over the keys. I'm waiting for them to save me. I'm waiting for them to jump over the table and say, "No, no, don't drink." I hand the keys. They said, "Go ahead." And they let me drink right in front of them. They were as clear about their own alcoholism as they were about my own. They were willing to let me get a full knowledge of my condition. They were willing to trust the grace of a God that would come between me and alcohol at some point, so that I can get a full knowledge of my condition. And thank goodness. Because when I came to out of that, a few days later, I was very clear about what does not keep me sober. Sponsors don't keep me sober. High intensive psychotherapy did not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. Memories of where my drinking had taken me, the consequences of where my next drink could take me, all of that was right in front of me, and it didn't even matter. I took a drink in a mental blank spot that was about as short as the snap of my fingers, without even thinking about it at all. All that stuff was absolutely irrelevant when I took that drink in front of those guys. So now I was left with hanging out in AA, knowing that I was beyond human aid, but afraid to go to God because I didn't think God wanted anything to do with me because of ideas about God that I was raised with. And I'm not blaming him. It's just what happened. I was born into a religion that told you not to drink. Okay? There was a lot of guilt and shame around drinking and all the other stuff that I was into because drinking was not my only problem. Okay? You know, drunken horse thief, you took away the booze, you got the horse thief. Right? That was me. And a bunch of other stuff. Okay? So the natural thing that a lot of us do is when we can't seem to grasp the higher power is use the group as a higher power, even as the higher power. And even Bill talks about that in the 12 and 12, but he talks about it as being a bridge. To me, the bridge didn't exist because I didn't think God wanted anything to do with me. And if this real recovery has anything to do with God, it's not in the cards for me. And I went to probably 1,000 meetings in the first year. I hung around great people. I got in the service to help the meeting operate because I had no message to carry, right? I got in all that kind of service. I helped set up the chairs. I picked up the cigarette butts. I greeted people. I made the coffee. I did all that stuff. And in that first year, I could not stay sober any more than 90 days. Just going to meetings and hanging out and being a participant and getting exposure, not experience, but experience, and just getting exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was not enough to solve this alcoholism that I had. And after about a year of that, I just came to the conclusion that I was too sick for AA, that I was some sort of different drunk than you were, that I was beyond the pale. And I just quit. I swore off AA. Like, I never swore off booze, but I swore off AA. Right? And so I started drinking on my last deployment to Australia because I thought, if I'm going to start relapsing, relapse here, you know. But anyway, it wasn't like it was a choice. That was the illusion, right? You know what? This is, Brian talked about this. Alcoholism is internal. The whole thing's internal. The cravings inside, the mental obsessions inside, and the spiritual malady inside. And so long as the spiritual malady can keep me believing that I'm making choices about taking the first drink, I am never, ever going to seek God as a solution because there's always going to be a part of me that thinks I can choose to do it or not do it. And as long as the higher power can perpetuate that lie inside me, I'll never seek God in the way that our program talks about because I think I don't need to because I can just choose in and choose out. It's the number one lie that the spiritual malady perpetuates in every alcoholic, that they're just choosing in and choosing out of their drinking. The first drink is a choice, then every drink after that is a choice also. Well, I just might as well get good and drunk now, because that's what it is, right? You're just choosing to drink the first, and then you choose to drink the second, and then the case, and then the week, and then the year, and then the decade. Every single drink after that first one was a choice, right? Not for me. But I believe that lie. Okay? So I start on this run. Ended up in jail there too. So I'm proud to announce that I've successfully been arrested in 5 of 7 continents, you know? And it's only because I haven't been to Antarctica and Africa. I told the captain, I said, I'm going to drink again. Don't worry about it. Nothing's going to happen. 3 days later, he's coming to the Townsville Australian jail and saying, what was that thing about nothing's going to happen? And so 10 weeks later, I got a sobriety date I wasn't even looking for. I dove back in a bottle and expected that to kill me at some point sooner or later, and I didn't even care. I was home now. I was back in Fresno, and I was shooting pool at Classic Billiards, table 13, and played table 13 because I was trying to increase my bad luck, you know. I was on a 10-week run, figuring I was fit for the VA psych ward at any time. And I was, you know, that's what you do to get ready for a job interview, because that's what I was doing, right? I was shooting pool at 11 a.m., cracking beers, getting ready for a job interview, right? I was never employable before, but I'm employable if I do that, you know? And so, and I drink one, I drink two, I bring the third one to my lips, and I can't drink it. And I threw the thing away. And I haven't had a drink since. And on two very rare occasions in the last, 22 years, almost 22 years I've been sober, have I ever had any inkling that I may drink again? It just has never, ever come up under any circumstances. And our book talks about that experience of being separated from alcohol by a higher power. And if a higher power has separated me from alcohol, which is the only thing that could have, then there is no human power, mine or yours, that can take me back to it. Okay? I did what Brian talked about instantly. I did not go off on the path of a spiritual tangent. No one had to worry about that. Okay? I went on the path of building a kingdom. I went on that to. I never had any economic or finances to recover. I just wanted to have some. Okay? And this is where, about the time Marty and I probably would have met, in Clovis AA. Okay? And from the pool hall at about 11:30, I headed over to a meeting I had been to while I was on leave a year earlier, in between stays at the psychiatric ward. You guys have heard of aftercare, right?
Yeah.
How many of you have heard of precare? No? I guess the sicker than most get on that, because that's what I was given. Okay, I was given precare, four meetings a week to get to my bed at the psych ward. And then I went to leave, right? And so I remembered this meeting that I had gone to at the old Gallo Winery in Fresno. And the Gallo family had donated this burnt-out building, a part of it, so that there could be a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous there. Maybe it was guilt or just nice. I don't know. But and the same guy that scared me to death the first time I was there was there again, and that was the guy that ended up asking me my sponsor. His name was Till. If he had told me up front that he was an active minister in a local Church of Christ, I would have told him to fuck off, because of my resentments towards Christianity at the time. He didn't lead with that, thank goodness. He was exactly what I needed. Let me tell you why he scared me. The first time. He scared me because he told a story. He told he was me. He had been like me at one point, and he was no longer like me anymore. He was where I wanted to be. And somehow, the first time in meeting him, I thought all of you did this. I thought you just kind of just came in here and you just made this change on your own. And I knew that that wasn't something that I had the capability of doing. And so I looked at this guy. He told my story. He told the story of falling out of graces with God, he believed. He talked about his alcoholism. He talked about the carousing with women and prostitutes and all this other stuff. He told my story to the T. And then he talked about his recovery and reestablishing this conscious contact, personal relationship with God. And I thought, wow, that's great for you. That'll never happen for me. So that intimidated me and scared me because I didn't. That's not something that I could do on my own, and it's still something I can't do on my own. And so when I got in front of that man at that meeting a year later, a little over a year later, the luxuries that come from not being desperate were gone. The gift of desperation drove me to ask him to be my sponsor. And I'd like to say I started doing steps, and I didn't. Like Brian talked about, I started building this kingdom that I thought would be conducive to liking my life. I'm still backing away from the idea of relying on God to recover. Okay? There's got to be some other angle. Right? It's like alcoholic death, spiritual basis in life, or a lot of money, or a hot girlfriend, or whatever. Something other than God, please. Right? And I ran through all of those sober and drove just about everybody crazy. I was unapproachable. I was a loose cannon. That first year of sobriety, I pulled my gun on trick-or-treaters. Christmas carolers. Okay? There were some young teenagers that were tapping on my windows just for kicks at my apartment complex. Okay. I don't know if that's PTSD or not. All I know is it pissed me off. They were just pranking. Stuff I've done did way worse as a teenager, right? So I said, you know what? I've stood fire watch before, I'll stand it again. And I waited for those punks to come by. And I had those guys down like I was in Kuwait. With my 30-30 lever action Winchester, model 92, like this. That security guard came around and go, "What are you doing?" and put the gun down. I said, "I'm doing your job." It'd still be another 9 months before I even saw the steps, you know what I mean? It's like and I was wearing those strippers out in San Francisco. I was fixing that, trying to fill that hole in my belly that I felt like the wind was blowing right through it that I just could not fill. I was bouncing through every character defect I could possibly come up with to try and fix the whole thing, and it just made it worse. And I finally got to a place at about a year of dryness, sobriety, that's what I call it. I was sobriety, right? Had a year of sobriety. And it just hit me. It wasn't a big deal. And then all of a sudden, like, it was like a light switch. Like the rules changed. And I'm sitting there up in Sonora, the old Sonora Inn, which is right along the 49, and right across this is hot summer, and right across was a saloon called the Brass Rail Saloon, right? It was just a honky-tonk, right? Loggers, bikers, and yeehaws, girls squealing, right? And I hate country western music, okay? But I was liking it right about then. And my window was open. I was on like the third floor, and I was like, "David, you get out of this bed, you are a drunk, dead duck." And I was scared to death. It was like a light switch. Canceled all my appointments. I was at my sponsor's doorstep the next morning. I said, we got to do this thing, the only thing that I haven't ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's these things called the steps, the actual program. I don't think it's going to work, but I at least want to be able to check the box and say, I have done everything A has ever asked of me, and I'm a failure, and just go on with my drunken life. He sat me with that day, and we walked through the book, steps 1, 2, 3. He told me to go write inventory. This is just the time it took me. I had that inventory done by Friday. I was scared to death. I was more afraid of what was going to happen if I didn't do it than if I did do it. Saturday, 5, 6, 7. Sunday, I walked out of there with an 8-step list. Okay? I walked out of there, I felt like I was walking 2 inches above the grass when I was walking across his lawn. Not because I was like all hyped up on God. I know that's what it was today, but that like something had completely changed, and I did like a nuclear mushroom cloud went off inside me, and like I had this clean slate. I had about 125 amends to make, and I started making those right away. Almost every single one of the amends I went out to make, especially in my community, ended up turning into some sort of service. The high school that I nearly got kicked out of, they asked me to come back and tell my story in health, when they went through alcoholism and drug addiction. And then in driver's ed, they came back to have me tell it again to when they talked about... So about halfway through that, he had wanted me to do that for the entire year, and about halfway through, the soccer coach came up to me. He was about to come into soccer season, and he said, I heard you play a lot of soccer here. I heard you're pretty good. And I said, I don't know if I was pretty good, but yeah, I play a lot of soccer. He goes, how would you like to be a coach here? I said, right. I said, doing this is one thing, but having the responsibility of 15 teenagers, and I sure, if you can make it fly. He called me that night and says, you want to coach? And I said, what'd they say? He said, keep a close eye on him. And so I got to coach at the school that kicked me out for being a bad influence. About halfway through the season, I had these parents coming up and telling me that I was a better influence on their kids and half the teachers that they had in school. And that's not about me, that's about AA, that's about you guys teaching me how to live. That's about a higher power changing me. I made amends to all those sheriffs. Half those sheriffs went to the church I was raised in. Right? Every Sunday they were in there talking to my parents. You know what your son was up to? You know how embarrassing that was for my parents, make amends to them. I used to do this really ugly thing with my parents because I always blamed them, right? I knew it wasn't, but I just wanted to strike out at somebody, so I struck out at the people that loved me the most. Every time I got a mugshot, I would sneak into the house because I wasn't allowed in the house. I would sneak into the house and put it right on the refrigerator and sneak out. Like, look what you did. Made amends for that. I'll never forget when my mom told me that I basically didn't sleep from the time you got a driver's license until you got sober. Wondering when it was going to be that moment I got the call. I've had so many friends driving around those mountain roads up there that have died from drinking. She just figured at some point I was going to be another one. And then I got evangelical because I had this spiritual enema going through the steps and I had to start... I was rocketed into the fourth dimension. I didn't know how to carry it any other way. And anybody that was a slow mover, I was in front of talking to about it. Okay? Started sponsoring guys. Driving everybody else crazy, but I started sponsoring guys. And that has never shut off. I ended up moving to Utah. I had already made amends and gotten straight with my upbringing in the LDS church. And just about the time I was bragging about how free I was is when I got moved to Utah for my job, Salt Lake City, as a matter of fact. And then got to get involved in AA there and met a lot of people and sponsored a lot of people there that I had two things in common with. And was extremely, extremely healed by that. And got to help some other people along the way. I cut my teeth on the 12-step work of going where the newcomers are at so I can help another alcoholic, and I got to stay sober in the process. I had to pull away from the popular meetings because I was dying in them. I was just kind of hanging out, rubbing elbows with old-timers and yuck-yucks, and we call them the paparazzi meetings, like the meetings that you go to be seen so everybody knows you're doing AA. It was killing me because I wasn't giving this thing away. I had to put myself in the middle of where I could talk to people that were like me and have an opportunity to really carry the message. And that's just me. I got involved in H&I. All of us were involved in H&I to some degree. I had a weekly thing down at the Fresno County Jail for years. And then it struck me one time. Kind of caused a little riot, but I had to pull away from H&I because intuitively my God consciousness was telling me that there was more people already sitting in the rooms looking for help than people I was seeing coming in from the jail. And a lot of people disagreed with the decision that I made about that. But I can't deny what God tells me to do. And from the time that I started doing that, it was a Thursday night commitment at the jail. I never not had somebody at my table doing steps on a Thursday night for 10 years. So I know that was the right decision to follow that intuition. I had to find my niche in service. I've done the gamut of general service. That's great that people do that. To me, Alcoholics Anonymous, at its core, like our forward tradition says, is simple and personal. And recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another about recovery. What happens with all that other stuff really doesn't impact that all that much. I know that when I was in general service, I like to think so. But it doesn't. And that's my niche. The one-on-one work, that's where it's at. I have a son. I'm a responsible father. I love it. I love him to death. I love being a father. I never thought in a million years what that would be like. I would have undersold it. I undersold it the whole way. I've had a lot of money. I've had no money. I've worked, not worked. I've been mad at God. I've rejected God. I've loved God, you know. And I'll close with this. I still wear my dog tags. I try to remember my dog tags all the time. And I do it for two reasons. I still have people I know that are in theater 20 years later. But more importantly, it signifies something to me. Because on my dog tags, what's stamped on there, when they asked me what my preference was for God, religion, I told them no preference. That was in 1989. They asked me again when we went to Kuwait for Desert Storm because they were going to cut real dogs, wartime dog tags. They want to see if you're going to change your answer, right? So they know what to do when they can bag you and tag you, how to do what they do to you. And they asked me, and I told them again, these are my wartime dog tags, no preference. And that wasn't about no preference to religion. That was about no preference to God because I didn't think he preferred me. I was talking about how they do their meditation during running. At one point, I was doing meditation in the morning at 4 o'clock in the pool at the gym when it was quiet, no lights, and doing a quiet breaststroke, silent breaststroke. I just was able to get really quiet. And one time, I was about 11, 12 years sober, and it had hit me just in the pool, just where it came from, that today is the most important relationship in my life is a relationship with God. And that because he gives me the opportunity to bring that to you, fulfills my life. And that that all those ideas that I thought I had that had separated me from God, the baptism didn't work when I was 8 years old. It didn't take, right? The going to AA initially and it not working. I came to realize that God was willing to let me go so far down the scale so I can be more effective with you now. And all of a sudden, any other negativity I had about my alcoholism and booze, which I really haven't had a whole lot of, but there's been times where like, man, this alcoholism sucks. And I realized, how can I be mad or angry or resentful towards that which has brought me to have this personal relationship with God and with you like I do? How can I be mad at that? Who cares what vehicle God used? Right? You guys have been great. You've been interested. I appreciate you guys asking me to come up here and share my story. And that's all I got. Thank you.